Once again, welcome to Rover Talk. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm good.
Good?
Yeah.
It's kind of hot outside today.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Full on summer. I know you like it hot, but...
I do. Anyway, so we got an interesting episode today. We're going to talk about a lot of stuff, but I wanted to remind everybody that if you want to reach out to us, it's rovertalk55 at Gmail, and you can find Dan on Instagram as WagonBoyTD, and you can find me as SRI2405. So today we got some stuff to talk about. We're going to go through the projects. We're going to go through a little bit of the market, and we're going to talk about the 1996 Land Rover Trek USA. And some of you were probably thinking, what the F is that? Okay, I'll tell you how we came to talking about that. But Dan, let's start off with our project. What have you been up to?
So I've been working on the 06 L322. As you know, recently I did like the rear shocks and the rear brakes. And, you know, while I was down there, I looked at the stabilizer bar and, you know, in the Chicago winters, that's one of the first things to just start to flake on the L322, basically on any Land Rover in Chicago. So, of course, I took mine off and blasted it, had it redone, and then so I will, if I'm taking it off, I'm going to try out these ARB bushings that are made specifically for the L322.
And these are polyurethane or are
they
rubber?
Nope, they're poly. So I'm like, I'll just try it. You know, what the hell? I got it off. You know, it was the first time that I had taken off a stabilizer bar. So it was kind of a learning process because there's no videos on it. So
nobody's done one yet?
No, they're, you know, it's surprisingly, you know, there's like a lot of like the same type of videos for the L322. Like there's always like the rear airbags, there's like just certain like little tricks, but there's a lot of things that you know, that I've come up where it's like, well, there's no video, and I'm like,
just a quick thank you to everybody that makes videos and posts them of things that need to be done or you know, little tips and tricks. Thank you for that. We live off of that.
Yeah. And so there wasn't one on here, and you know, there's a lot of stuff in the way. It doesn't just like come off. So I managed to figure out a trick, and then it also reminded me like, why aren't we doing you know, videos for stuff like that? But you know, I'm always doing it at 4 a.m. and you know, just doesn't seem to work out.
Dan doesn't like to sleep.
So that that replaced, and then, you know, I told you about this when I was down at the farm. We added another trail.
Ooh, check out the new trail on Dan's Instagram. That's a cool one.
It was really nice of the farmer to kind of take the initiative to help me clear it. So now it's a full circle now. Which is great without leaving the property, so it's kind of nice. Other than that, like the knock on wood, the disco's been awesome. The other ones have all been.
So the disco, you had the gearbox rebuilt.
Yeah, that's been a while, and it's been you know, running great.
Is there a noticeable difference now?
I mean there is, in the sense of. As far as the shifting goes, yeah, there's a noticeable difference between first and second, of course. And then, you know, there wasn't an issue with 5, and that's usually where you see the problems with the 77, is you'll start to hear this crazy whine in fifth gear, and, you know, the kid's telling you, you know, slow it down, knock it off, go down to 4th. But, you know, I wasn't having, you know, that issue. And since I was doing some clutch work anyways, it was just, you know, as I always say, when you're down there. While I'm in there, just take care of, you know, whatever's, you know, down there. So that's just basically it.
Nice. Well, I have actually had a week where I haven't done much. The only thing I got done is, If you're interested, you contact me. I have a, that Dan just saw, a 1995 three-door, 300 TDI five-speed manual in, is it Alpine or is it Severin? I don't know.
You know, I didn't look at the color tag. I mean.
It doesn't have one.
It doesn't have one? It
doesn't have one.
I mean, I would go with Alpine just because of the.
Not that I don't know, but the colors are basically exactly the same. But I can't remember in Europe 1995 if it was called Alpine or it was called Severin White. But right. It was one of the two.
Yeah. I will say when you were approaching my house, I was like, that looks.
It's pretty cool. It has a
pretty amazing.
It has a bull bar with two big spotlights in the front. It's got a roof rack, which is a serious like heavy duty.
That rack has to be total custom because it didn't. I would say maybe half and half, but it's pretty amazing. I'm pretty jealous of that rack just because it's super super practical and it's not obnoxiously like bulky. It's really good.
Very cool rack. Very solid. And the interior is beige. It's absolutely stunning. And the best part is that it has 182,000 kilometers, and that's going up because I'm using it, which is about 112,000 miles, I think, if we did the mathematical conversion. Anyway.
And it's the 300.
It's the 300 TDI.
Yeah.
The only thing that this car needed was a new headliner because, as we all know, all of us that are classic Rover owners, the headliner will droop sooner or later. So I had that done. You know, the what I've started doing, and I think this is something you can probably do yourself, is instead of taking it to a shop and having them take the headliner board out and redo it and put it back in, you can actually save a lot of money if you take it out and just give it to them and say, cover it. Now, this is very easy to do on a Range Rover Classic because, there's basically nothing, there's nothing to it really. But on the Discovery, it's a little bit more complicated. If anybody has to do it, you start off by taking off the inside panels that go along the side of the that go along the Safari windows. Those have basically like clips. And then take off the seat belts, both the rear and the front. And all you need to do is slightly pull back the interior trim pieces on both sides. And then, of course, in the front, you've got that plastic piece that goes across that where you can stick paperwork in there up there, and that comes off with a few screws, and then your sun visors come off with a few screws too, and then your dome light also. It's super easy.
Now, did yours have a skylight? Have a sunlight?
No, this has no sunroofs. This is a non-sunroof car.
That's like the trifecta.
It is. The only thing that it's missing is. Crank windows.
It has electric windows.
It has electric windows. Yeah, that's.
Well, I mean, just the fact that it has no sunroof is. I mean, that's like.
And of course,
that's the best.
Not a speck of rust. Anyway, if you're gonna do this, it's totally doable. You know, at least like take it to the shop and in the parking lot, you can get that out really easily, and it's gonna save you a lot of money. I've seriously paid three times more than what I paid to have this one done, just dropping it off at an upholstery shop and then having them do it and reinstall it. And the reinstallation process, it's almost easier to get it in than it is to get it out. So if you have a disco and you need this done, like a serious way to save money is to actually take the headboard out yourself. Let the professionals cover it because they're going to leave it perfectly smooth everywhere and they're going to know the right way to get it done. If you're good at that, then hey, it's totally a do-it-yourself job. But
yeah,
that's all that needed to be done on this car. It runs amazing. I bought this in the south of Spain in Jaén in a town called Martos. It's 200 vehicle. I had it repainted in Spain because as it's pretty common and all of us Rover owners know that the clear coat starts going as soon as you leave it out in the sun for a little while. Like, you know,
do they have sun in Spain?
No.
No.
It's just it's the street lights.
Yeah.
And you know that if you leave it out in the sun for any longer than 10 or 15 minutes, the clear coat is going to peel back.
Yeah.
But that's kind of all I've had to do this week. It's kind of cool. I have another. Oh, and I did I tell you about my find?
Mm-mm.
Well, I found what many of our American listeners would consider the holy grail of the Range Rover, which is 3-door, 3.9, 5-speed manual.
Oh, awesome.
No sunroof.
Even better.
And I found this car. Actually, you
is
know.
Is that the green one?
Yes.
Yeah.
This one came to me actually. Sometimes you just get lucky and like, and people that have, that I've bought other cars from, they're like, oh, I have this. And the excuse me. The best part is that it only has 142,000 kilometers. Single owner.
Wow.
1990 model year, first year 3.9. So that one hopefully will be arriving, I'm thinking probably mid to late August.
Awesome.
So that's one of the combinations I've driven, but I haven't owned. A 3.9 manual and a 3-door. So that one will be coming up. You'll see it on my Instagram. You'll probably see it on Dan's Instagram too. So if that's your cup of tea, then definitely give me a shout. Dan, what's been going on in the market?
I'd say it's still stable. There hasn't been any like huge influx of pricing on anything. Everything is kind of staying, where it should be. Even as we head into, a recession, I don't think it's going to be really catastrophic. I think it just finally stabilized. Because guys, we'll still buy cars, whether we should or we shouldn't. You know what I mean? We're just not going to spend like, crazy 2021 money on cars. And we just had a couple of big tent shows, and as usual, Land Rovers, either they like sell for nothing there, or you get a drunk person that's like has no idea. But this last auction, things were actually pretty cheap and compared to the rest of the market. So
yeah. So I saw this. Well, you sent me a link on there's a car that I was interested in talking about, which is a 1995 long wheelbase that had a transplant 300 TDI and a 5-speed. Bring a trailer car. In fact, it ends tomorrow. If you're interested, get on there and bid on it. It's at 18 grand, which I think is a very conservative or low number. I think this one's going to blow up tomorrow, but
that one actually, I'm very familiar with that car. I've actually followed that car for a few years now, and there's so many like perfect things about it, because it's a long wheelbase. It's, even though I'm a two-door guy, this has four doors. It's a long wheelbase 300. It's in a iconic BRG. There's just so many like really good things about it, and it had kind of a full restoration probably 5 or 6 years ago. And it has, enough like little flaws to it that you're not going to be like super paranoid to like take it off road, but it still looks amazing. So, I think it's kind of a sleeper. Definitely at 18, I think it's a little low, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah. The only thing, it was apparently, done by J.E. Robinson Service of Springfield, Massachusetts, or at least that's when I think the conversion was done. The only thing is that, and here's a call out to bring a trailer. So it shows 142,000 miles, right? Which is, if you're talking about a 300 TDI, that's very, very normal number. I mean, I wouldn't consider it high, super high. I wouldn't consider it low.
I'm going to only assume that is the chassis mileage.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Here's what I always wonder, and the reason I'm saying this, because I'm in the process of putting together a few of these cars that have engine transplants in them, and so I'd really like to know, like, the origin of the engine, right?
Yeah.
Maybe, and given that it was apparently done, I guess the seller acquired it in 2018, and if it's the place is known, then like I want to know. That's what I'm missing with all of these that have an engine transplant.
Yeah,
I want to know what the engine was from. Like, where did it come from? Did it come from a Defender? Did it come from a Disco? Did it come from another Range Rover?
Yeah.
What was done to the engine before? I mean, not sometimes it's hard on these engines to know what the mileage on them was, but were the heads done? Kind of like more information on what you're getting inside.
Right.
Like 142 is fine because that's chassis mileage, and then this has a new gear. The gearbox is the same thing. The gearbox and the motor are new. So basically, I mean, it doesn't bother me that it has 142, but I want to know about the mileage.
Yeah.
And if you don't know about that, at least tell me the engine was installed when the clock was hitting whatever that was.
Right.
You know, that's always kind of like my thing with transplanted cars. It's like, document the engine. Or, you know, just like say, hey, we bought this at a junkyard and we looked it over. We did it. We performed a compression test, which I'm assuming everybody does before putting a new engine in. It gave great compression. And we stuck it right in.
Sure.
Because, I mean, you can look at the serial code on these and you can decipher where they're from, or
right.
at least the year, or,
yeah.
you know. Even, you know, these TDIs are going to say 21L or 16L or 18L, depending on, you know, where it is. Like, the Discos, the Defender ones usually say 16L. The Discos usually say 21L. Anyway. Or 12L, it could be, too. Just a little bit of more information. But anyway, that was kind of a... I thought it was a cool car because... Dan, you asked me the other day if a long wheelbase...
Yeah, if they had ever made that sort of configuration naturally, having a diesel in a long wheelbase. And
so my answer, and please, if you know the accurate answer to this, correct us, send us an email or contact us in some way. My understanding was that the long wheelbase models... were mainly made for the U.S. market and for Middle East.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that they all had 4.2s originally and that none of them had a manual.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't even know if there was a 4.2 with a manual even in
well
like
that's
a...
that's just it, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not really sure. If someone has one or has an original one, that would, you know, reach out to us. I'd love to hear about it. But as far as I know, the manual was only a 3.9 thing. 3.5, 3.9, and the turbo diesels, of course.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's also a car that I think is very undervalued on Bring a Trailer, and it's a 1991 short wheelbase. It's in Canada. It's in Oak Bay, and it's
you're talking about the Westminster?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has 223,000 miles, which is a lot. Okay.
Yeah, but if you look at it, it looks like way better than some $100,000 mile ones. Like
if you're in the market for a car, that might be your car.
Because it's already lived in the U.S. So getting it back is a lot easier.
Yeah, the cluster's in miles.
Yeah,
for starters. So
and it lived in California for a while.
So here's the thing. Here's what I would do with that truck. Right, if I want a lot of people don't want to go through this, and I understand it because you're not going to get instant gratification, but this is the type of car that you can buy, which is probably going to end up at a very reasonable price, unless us saying it here is going to set people on the bidding path. But it looks outstanding. It's with 5 days left, it's at $4,000.
Yeah,
this one might, you know, I don't know what the reserve is, honestly, but this is the perfect car to buy it and send the engine to be rebuilt. And you're going to spend whatever the car goes for, plus maybe another, if you find a good place, maybe 6-7, and you're going to end up with a car that looks outstanding, that seems to be in very good shape with a brand new rebuilt engine.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, screw the mileage. Like, at that point in time, who cares?
Well, or I would just buy it, hold it, and then... like in that color, I think converting it to EV would just be amazing.
Yeah.
You know, because you're at that point where like you do have like so many miles on it, but like everything else about that thing is like it's really good. So it's like, you know, we're almost there where, you know, more and more shops and we'll do an episode on EV in the future. But like to me, like, that's a really great candidate to.
Yeah, that absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. But that one's, for me, if it stays where it's staying right now, it's totally a market find. And I can understand that it is, because a lot of people that might not be the enthusiast or wants a car right away doesn't want to buy a car and then rebuild the engine, right? Because that's kind of like a pain in the ass. But I would go that route 100% with this car. Or like you say, hold on to it and turn it into
EV. I can't wait to see what it closes at.
Yeah, that one's going to be interesting. Anyway, so those are kind of the market finds. Also, I know Dan. I'll get onto the P38. So I had one of our listeners, Nathan. I hope you're listening. Came to visit me this Sunday. He wanted to check out my 300 TDI Disco. And Nathan, thank you for coming. Your wife and you and your wife are wonderful people. It was great to meet you. Regardless of that, Nathan's entry, and I think a lot of people, the entry into Land Rover for all of us was kind of different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Into Land Rover ownership. And Land Rover has converted many of us into mechanics, like that famous like bumper stickers head. But anyway, Nathan's entry, like many people's entry, has been into the P38. And I can already see Dan's face, like, talking P38. He's looking at me saying, no, I don't want one.
There was one that I would have been more than happy to own that closed on Bring a Trailer last week. I thought it was the most beautiful.
Which one was that?
So it was someone had taken a P38 that was Oxford blue, that had done a full-on over-the-top build on it. You could probably pull it up pretty quickly. And the reason why I loved it is because of how it, like, kind of distracted you from the design of the P38,
which it distracted you from what it really is.
Exactly. Like, you know, I mean, you know my take on, I think it's the worst designed.
Oh, was it this one that was, it must have been this one that was, like, modified, like, bumper and.
Yeah, everything.
Oh, this thing is awesome.
Yeah. And it actually sold for pretty cheap, considering how much I know what that build would cost to do, but at least it made it a little less ugly, if you will. But anyway, so Nathan came by.
Yeah, Nathan came by. So his entry into the Land Rover ownership is a P38, of which has some, you know, general electrical gremlins like they all tend to have. Here's the thing, and I know Dan's not going to agree with me on this one, but the reality is that, like, the forums are absolutely full. If you have a P38 or want a P38, like, somebody's been through your problem.
100%.
So, like, I wouldn't be afraid of it. Now, would I think that it's going to be as reliable as a TDI? No, not going to happen.
Yeah.
But with that said, I mean, even the EAS suspension, if you, like, there's a manual you can download.
I mean, it's pretty easy.
You know, it's let's face it, it's early 1990s technology. It's not complicated, even if you want to keep it as an air suspension.
Yeah.
So shout out to Nathan for going that way. I'm sure he's going to get his problem resolved. And then, again, we always say this. Scour through eBay, and, you know, the American parts suppliers are great, but the suppliers of the suppliers are all the same globally. So look into the UK. There's lots of different websites that will offer you parts for every single Rover model. Yeah. So it's very difficult for you to find a part that you can't get. That I don't think there is that case. Now, I'm not talking about, like, interior trim and, you know, little things that fall off. Those are kind of hard to get. But, like, mechanical parts, you're going to find, you know, basically everything. So look at your UK suppliers. Don't think, remove that American auto parts mentality. Because that's not going to happen. You're not going to go over to AutoZone or Napa and find it. Although they might, Napa might have it. But
and just always keep in mind, there's a ton of crossover with BMW.
There is. And, because the P38, like, in the diesel model that I have,
it
didn't even.
The full on, it said full
the valve
on
covers say BMW. Yeah. They didn't even bother to change that. Anyway, it was great. So if you're, you know, reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you and meet you if we can. Nathan, thanks for coming by. It was great to meet you. I'm sure your P38 issues will be resolved. I'll send you a list of suppliers this week for sure. And keep us posted on how that issue goes, if that's the case. Anyway, P38. So the other day, as I was wasting time on YouTube like I usually do.
Yeah.
I don't know if I... Did you do that too?
No, I don't. No. No, I don't.
You don't? Well, I do. No. Anyway. So I came across a video, and I'd love to remember who it was. Is this guy that they gave a couple down in like Georgia gave him for free a Disco XD. Right?
Right.
So this is a Gen 1. So Dan, tell us about the Disco SD first.
So the XD was just like the brainchild of I believe it was like Bob Burns. He ran like the Land Rover University, like out east, where they kind of, you know, indoctrinated all of like the salesmen and just kind of like getting people, you know, getting people within Land Rover to like basically join the cult and just eat, you know, drink, breathe like everything Land Rover. And so he had this idea of how can we get, you know, Land Rover out there as far as like 4x4, because as you know, like before that, really in 96, we had literally only just come off of the Classic, and that was just kind of seen as, you know, upscale, you know, yuppie kind of thing. And so Land Rover was looking to kind of show people, you know, really what the brand can do. And you know, we were 2 years into the Disco in the States. And so he wanted something that could stand out at the dealerships and all that. And so he came up with, we didn't really come up with XD, because XD was code for these Wolf Defenders that they were making at the time. So it was really kind of a code name that had been around, but it sounded cool, just kind of like how every car has like these acronyms that like really just don't mean anything, but they sound cool. But he did come up with putting them in, you know, AA or AA, which is, you know, pretty famous yellow that Land Rover has used in many vehicles. And so he came up with this idea of having this vehicle and creating sort of a platform to showcase this vehicle. And so it started out with making 28 of the special discos that had, you know, extra equipment that you couldn't get on the other ones, like the wraparound brush bars.
Do you have a list of the special equipment there?
I do.
Go through it.
Yeah. So they all came in the AA yellow exterior with the black hood with the XD logo on the hood. It had the black caster alloy wheels, Safari roof rack, wraparound brush bars, which go, you know, covering both the side lights and the front Land Rover driving lights, the rear light guards, which kind of started out like that whole thing of, you know, accessorizing that, you know, is common, that runs throughout the whole run of the discos. Has the engine protection plate underneath the rear ladder. Came with a really cool XD spare tire cover, beige cloth interior with XD seat covers, rubber floor mats. And then you could get the extra decal package, which was it like a dealer option that you could add like all these extra decals, which you know, kind of runs into an issue later, like today, when you're trying to identify like the actual XDs and then the ones that they made as a special edition, and you know, of which there is 250 of those.
So wait, let me understand here. So if I'm getting this correctly,
yeah,
there were 28 original XDs.
Yeah, 28 original that had extra kitted, mainly like the protection plate and stuff, so that they were gonna run in the event that you're gonna talk about.
Okay.
And then after they did the event, then they slated to release 250, kind of as like get people excited. You know,
yeah, okay.
they saw the track.
Got it.
They're like, how can I get that cool? They kind of did a kind of a stripped down version of the Trek vehicle that they made.
Okay. And did so I it's my understanding that the 28 were all in AA yellow.
100%.
And after that, could you get of the 250 that were made, could you get one that was different color, or they
no, they were all AA. The only thing that you could do is that you could add things to it, but we see a lot of those special vehicles that were some were not didn't add certain like decal packages, and so it gets really kind of muddy when you're looking to buy one, making sure that you're, you know, actually getting a true one of those 250s, because now that, as you know, like there's tributes of everything.
And all of these I'd assume all of these had the 4.0 and automatic trans.
So I'm not 100% about the Trek versions.
So the Trek there might have been some manuals.
I mean, I wouldn't have done it without. Why?
Well, I would have done. Yeah, I would have done a manual too.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that there wouldn't, especially in '96, because they were making discos with the manuals in 96s.
Oh yeah.
So I can only assume that there had to have been. I don't know 100% if they had kitted them.
Yeah.
All with manuals.
Okay. Well, they certainly a cool looking car. I have one pulled up here on one of previous sale from Ring of Trailer. Anyway, so at this point in time, the marketing manager for, well, I don't know whose idea it was, but anyway, someone at Land Rover decided that it would be a great idea to set up the 1996 Land Rover Trek in the United States. Now, this event.
Well, first tell us what time of year it was and where in the States it was.
Okay. So,
because I think that'll paint a picture if someone isn't familiar with this Trek.
This was literally middle of summer, and it was 45 minutes east of Atlanta, Georgia.
So the swampiest, most humid, like disgusting
so
place.
So hot as balls.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And humid.
Humid.
Right? And so the funny part about this event is that there's a lot of funny in this.
Yes.
Event. Anyway, let's go through it. So the event was basically a few days long, and it was specifically for dealerships to participate. So what they would do is they would take, most of the people were either salespeople or actual technicians from the dealerships from the United States and Canada, and they could sign up and send a team to down to Georgia in the middle of the summer and participate in this event. So for those of you that are thinking, oh, well, you know, the conditions when they did these events in Brunei or Malaysia were just as bad. No, wait. You got to take a step back. This was a full-on event that included biking and canoeing and running and mud bogging and trying to cross a river walking on logs that were supported by wooden, like by gas barrels. I mean, this was like
it was basically a triathlon with a rover thrown in it.
Yeah. Or if you watch like that show that's on MTV for many, many years called The Challenge, I see a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
There. So what? Okay. But not only was it that, it also included some like academic parts, right? So, for example, they'd wake these poor people up at like 4 a.m. and they'd make them do a test on like service procedures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or they would make them, how to change a tire in the middle of the mud, or all sorts of different things that they put these people through. Now, nothing to them. I would have done it in a heartbeat. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I think this is absolutely hilarious. But to be honest, you got to think that it's a bunch of fat white guys trying to get through the mud, you know, and yeah. like running up these and cycling where they're like, you know, falling every 2 feet because they can't get up this hill. I mean, if you think about, if you see some of the images, which I highly recommend that you look it up on YouTube, like some of this stuff is like, you know, professional level, like triathletes would have some difficulty doing it. It's kind of like the
American Ninja Warrior.
Yeah.
Doing. Yeah.
Anyway, this is, I mean, it's just great. So,
So was it just down to you know, like how like the Camel Trophy was, you know, it was partially race, and then it would have like all these like challenges of like, you know, crossing like this mud and like getting across in a certain amount of time. Was it point driven? Was it like
so yes,
or was it just to humiliate these people?
Well, the global idea, according to Land Rover, was that they would be able to give like a super special type of training to all the people that worked at Land Rover, so that when to like kind of like get them into like the 4x4 and off road life, right?
Yeah,
that was the general idea. Now, I'll make a quick stop here. We have to keep in mind this is 1996. Let's say that it took like a couple of years to get this event organized, maybe a year, right? In 1995-96, Land Rover was still an off-road vehicle company, right?
Yeah.
We didn't have anything close to the L322. We hadn't been a luxury automobile company like it kind of is right now. And there hadn't been that big SUV boom in the United States yet.
No.
Right?
No.
So Land Rover had these centers where they were like back east, where they would take you on, you know, your test drive was literally up a 45 degree angle in the mud, right? So mm-hmm. you could actually test out.
Yep.
And if we think about, like you mentioned, like you very well mentioned before, if you think about the Land Rover model range, at that point, we had in the US, we only had the Range Rover Classic, and we had just started with the P38, which came out in 1990, well, at the tail end of this.
And very limited, as we know, in 96, a very limited number of the 94s and 95s, 90s. We had, you know, a few hundred of the 93 110s in the Defender family. So, you know, we didn't even have, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't even think a Midwest team was part of that Land Rover truck, because we didn't really have any Land Rover centers to speak of. Like you could get, you know, a Land Rover. I know where I grew up, you could get it, you know, with other British car dealerships, but we didn't have like full on Land Rover, you know, dealerships.
No.
Up there at that time.
Yeah.
Or in Chicago at that time.
Yeah. And then at one point, now, this lasted, I believe, a week. And it started off being 31 teams, of which they didn't have enough cars. So some people did it in Camel Trophy versions of the disco.
Oh, okay.
And then it ended up being 5 different teams. Now, why they did 5 doesn't make any sense to me, because there were parts of the competition of the last few days that were actually team versus team. So you had to have a team. They had to have a little substitute team that would compete against the last one.
Okay.
Just to make it interesting, because you're going to have these side by side little treks where you're only racing one.
Right.
Anyway. And this last part of the series was actually televised by ESPN2. So you had like serious like announcers. They were like doing play by play. And clearly, if you think about it, it's kind of hard to narrate a play by play of a car. Well, a people humiliating triathlon in a car race.
Yeah.
And I was just asking, you know, we were talking about this, Dan and I, before, like, what was ESPN 2 in 1996?
It was like almost cable access. I mean, it really, it's like the Weather Channel. Like, it really hadn't, like, you know, today, you know, cable and everything like that is completely different. But back then, not everybody had access to ESPN 2.
Yeah. So they, ESPN 2 probably saw the chance to, like, you know, let's stick something else we don't have to worry about, you know. So that was, that's kind of, and that's what you'll find on YouTube is the ESPN 45-minute narration of it. But it's interesting because it shows us, you know, it's 2022. That was 26 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And in 26 years, the evolution of Land Rover as a mark is, it's just, it's gone from being an off-road company to being a luxury vehicle company.
Yeah.
And, you know, think about the evolution that they had. If you take 25 years back in 1971, the only thing you could get was a series Rover. So the evolution was, you had a 71, you had the first Series 3s plus a lot of Series 2As. And then in 1996, we had the Disco and the Classic and the Defender. And now we have a whole array of different luxury vehicles. You know, the Evoque and the Disco and the LR3 and the LR2 and everything. So it's interesting to see how, even though Land Rover doesn't seem like a company that's evolved a lot, it actually kind of has.
Yeah.
And especially in these past 25 years. Because, of course, all of these discos that you're seeing here, I mean, ABS, no. Traction control, no. You know, there is still the essence of the Gen 1 disco.
Right.
So these are really cool. Anyway, it's truly hilarious.
Which is why I couldn't do that in an automatic. I mean, I would have to have a manual.
Yeah, if you look at some of, like, you'll see some of the footage and you'll see some of the things that they put them through, and you realize that I think at one point the announcers talk about, the pundits talk about the being an automatic or not, and I can't remember if there were.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't make any sense to do that in an automatic. It would just be too difficult.
Yeah.
But it's actually really, really, really funny to watch because, you know, clearly there were, you know, a lot of these, you know, old fat white guys that worked in Land Rover, that probably knew an amazing amount of knowledge about anything Land Rover. But I don't know if they were expecting to have to, like, ride a bike through the mud and
kayak 50 miles down a river. Yeah.
But it certainly seems like everybody had a lot of fun, which is, I think, the end result. And the other side of it, it's funny that Land Rover would invest that amount of, like, money and capital, and how important they thought their actual technical teams and sales force was, because this was actually an event for them. This was actually an event designed to train their people, right? Their employees. Yeah. So that they would understand, you know, the 4x4 life a little bit more, and the off-roading stuff. And I'm sure that it made amazing, you know, technicians and salespeople, because they were, you know, very equipped after
and
that.
Now I can only assume that has to be commonplace, and not that they're like canoeing and stuff, but, like, you know, I would assume that most companies like that immerse their salespeople, into that sort of environment. If they're selling it.
There was actually a 2020 or 2021 Trek and Discoveries. We'll talk about that one in another episode. But Modern Discoveries, proper year Discoveries.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm sure that now they probably totally appreciate only having to work at the Land Rover Experience Centers, because they're pretty amazing. I've been to a few, but it's definitely a lot easier than what those teams went through back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's there's a different perspective too. I think the there's just a little bit less of the. I don't think Land Rover is the preferred vehicle for, you know, I'm going to off-road expedition, or at least a modern Land Rover.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to take an autobiography through the middle of Africa. Although I'd absolutely love to do that. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd take my L322 through the middle of Africa if I had the opportunity to.
Yeah.
For sure. But it was a different company, or it was a different you know, different mindset back then. Anyway, it is an absolutely hilarious how they, it's just at what point, and a lot of, I think a lot of that stuff too was also designed to create teams, right? Because a lot of it was
team building.
It was team building, right?
Yeah.
But imagine they took, imagine you work at a company and they do a team building retreat at where you work and they take cameras and put it on ESPN too, right?
Yeah.
For
right.
everybody to see you, you know, jumping in the, jumping around blindfolded in a potato sack while you fall on your face. Anyway, it's a very cool it's a very cool thing to watch. I thought it was really interesting because here's the thing, I didn't know about this.
And what, how's the quality like, compared to like YouTube?
1996. It's almost like it's done on like traditional film. The quality is horrendous.
Oh, so basically then it's someone taping something off of VHS.
If you're less than 30 years old, you're going to think that this was like when we watch a Charlie Chaplin movie.
Yeah, it's probably VHS. And
yeah. But it's cool that it's out there. So I thought that I thought this was interesting because it, for me, it's kind of like a retrospective to look at Land Rover as a brand and the evolution.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think they tried to tailor it a lot to like, look like or seem like or be like the Camel Trophy. And honestly, I'm sure there were little itty bitty parts that did, but I mean, in general, the gruesomeness of the Camel Trophy has nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
And the Camel Trophy didn't require people to, you know, ride a bike for 10 miles through the mud or or do canoeing exercises.
Yeah.
Or at least not voluntarily. So anyway, we thought that was something kind of cool and kind of awkward of well, awkward, I think special about Land Rover, and I'm sure that the people that did it certainly enjoyed it, and for them it was a lot of fun. I would have loved to do it even though I'd never worked at Land Rover, but
yeah.
So anyway, I think Dan, I think we're gonna cut this one a little bit shorter today. We've been going pretty long on our episodes.
Yeah.
Know. So if you think that we're talking or I blabber too much, please let us know. Dan, thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, of course.
I'm glad you got to see the 300 TDI.
That's awesome.
Watch out for that. As we always say, please reach out to us, like correct us, tell us what you think. Rovertalk55@gmail.com. WagonBoyTD on Instagram and SRI2405 on Instagram too. And we will be back with you soon.
All right. Bye, guys.